From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a nuclear scientist challenges data supporting that proposed underground nuclear waste repository near Lake Huron.
Look, you messed up the most basic first step in establishing the safety of this facility, namely how much radioactive waste are we going to be putting in the ground. You admit you got that wrong, but now you're telling me that everything else is okay.
Jack Lessenberry on the re-election troubles and career of Congressman John Conyers.
I was told as a kid that it's always better to leave a party a little bit before they want you to leave rather than an hour after they wish you would have gone.
And the power of positive business.
There's so much potential that's untapped in people that if leaders can become more skilled at bringing out that potential, then it creates a lot of value.
Those stories and more. A power company wants to bury radioactive waste less than a mile away from Lake Huron in Kincardine, Ontario. Now, a scientist who once worked for that power company is speaking out, and he says some of the materials that would be stored underground are hundreds of times more radioactive than what was told to government officials. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what these new findings could mean for the Kincardine Project and for the Great Lakes. Then, vintage trailer fans from around the country are heading to Camp Dearborn this weekend. It's the Tin Can Tourists annual gathering. We'll talk travel trailers with them later this hour. But first, it was likely not the birthday gift that Congressman John Conyers would have wished for. The Democratic congressman, who turns 85 this Friday, will be filing an appeal with the state after yesterday's announcement by Wayne County Clerk Kathy Garrett that he did not have enough valid signatures on his nominating petitions to be on the August primary ballot. Garrett says only 592 of the necessary 1,000 signatures are valid. Many signatures were disqualified because the people collecting those signatures were not registered voters, and according to the law, that voids the signatures they collected. If his appeal to the state fails, Conyers is talking about mounting a write-in campaign for the primary. Well, all of this has those who have watched John Conyers since he was first elected to Congress in 1964 thinking back about his epic journey through the decades and what an ending to a career that all of this could be. We're joined by Michigan Radio's political commentator, Jack Lessenberry. As someone who has dealt with the congressman and with his office, Jack, are you surprised by this snafu?
I think it's startling, but not greatly surprised. There's been a sense of disorganization, and they turned it over to, in fact, the oddest thing of all is this is the second congressman to happen in two election cycles. Remember, of course, Republican Thaddeus McConner was a victim of pretty much the same thing. In that case, it was his own staff submitting photocopied signatures because they were too lazy to go collect them. But in this case, Conyers hired a couple consultants. And I want to correct something I said earlier on the air, which was that one of these two consultants was Adolf Mongold, a notorious political consultant. He tells me this morning that it was actually his brother Skip, that he often works with Skip, but this time Skip Mongold was collecting signatures on his own. But be that as it may, Skip Mongold and Steve Hood, two political consultants, apparently hired these people without checking their ID. Now, the ACLU is filing a lawsuit saying that people collecting signatures shouldn't have to be registered voters, but the point of whether they prevail or not, the point is that that was the rules, it's been the rules for 50 years, and nobody in the Conyers campaign checked to see if the rules were being followed.
In fact, Steve Hood did kind of a public mea culpa that was posted this morning, basically falling on the sword, saying, I didn't check, I should have, and I didn't.
Right.
Well, you know, many only know Conyers as the 80-something-year-old at the tail end of his career in Congress. If you could, I'd like you to take us back to his early years. What was he like in Washington?
Conyers was a firebrand. We have to remember he sort of came out of a tradition. Father was a UAW organizer who was sort of purged from the union, but he was a member of sort of a left-wing faction who was sort of purged by Walter Reuther back in the days of the Red Scare. And so John Conyers, always grew up sort of outside the establishment. He was elected to Congress. He won a very close primary by 108 votes in 1964. And he originally was very much sort of a maverick. When he got to Congress, there were only five black congressmen total. There are well over 40 now. And he, from the start, almost the start, he opposed Lyndon Johnson on Vietnam, a little quietly at first, but then more loudly. Conyers introduced a resolution calling for Richard Nixon's impeachment before Watergate. In fact, in response to his bombing and invasion, I believe, of Cambodia, he was a firebrand on the House Judiciary Committee that voted to impeach Richard Nixon. And then, of course, a quarter of a century later, he was defending Bill Clinton on the same committee. Only congressman in history who has been part of two impeachment hearings. But as time went on, a lot of people felt that his skills had sort of eroded, and frankly, his lucidity had. But I think people have to ask themselves, is this gentleman at age 85 with some history of erratic behavior, should this gentleman continue to serve in Congress?
Well, now we've got the ruling that most everyone expected from Wayne County Clerk Kathy Garrett, that Conyers is not eligible for the primary ballot. And you wrote in Dole Magazine, your quote was, it's hard to imagine him going gently into that post-congressional night. What do you think he will do?
I think that he will fight this in the courts, and he will try a write-in campaign. Now, people remember, of course, that last year, Mike Duggan surprised everybody by running a very successful write-in campaign and getting a majority of the primary vote when he was running for mayor. But that was an anomaly. There's lots of reasons to think that was an anomaly. One thing, everybody in Detroit felt that Mike Duggan had been robbed, that he was unfairly tossed off the primary ballot for a technicality. There was also a very strong feeling among African-American voters as well as white ones that he was perhaps the only person who could sort of save Detroit, who could do what needed to be done as mayor. But most write-in campaigns fail abysmally. There have been U.S. senators, most U.S. senators who've tried it have been off the ballot, lost their re-elections. 2 years ago, in the 11th Congressional District, where we had this situation where the other, where Thaddeus McCotter failed to get on the ballot, the Republican establishment, put a whole lot of energy into trying to get people to write in Nancy Cassis, a well-known state senator who waged a write-in campaign trying to win the primary nomination. She was defeated 2-1 by Kerry Bentivoglio, who was the only name on the ballot. So my guess is it's going to be an uphill battle. You never say never, and Conyers has been a congressman for longer than most voters have been alive, but it's going to be very hard for him to win a write-in.
Well, as we referred to earlier, there are some legal challenges going on, which could mean he could possibly get on the ballot. Here's John Conyers yesterday.
There are other major considerations that, to me, is work unfinished that I wouldn't want to be leaving to anybody that hasn't compiled the experience and track record that I have.
Should he have gotten a farewell lap and a chance to be the dean of the House after John Dingell retires, or is it time to bow out, albeit not voluntarily?
Well, everybody can say there's always unfinished business, always things that need to be dealt with. But the fact is, while Conyers had been the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, the House is now in Republican hands. Almost nobody believes Democrats have a chance to take back the House. I'm not sure that he would be reinstated as committee chairman if they did. And I think that John Dingell, who's been in Congress almost 10 years longer, decided sort of, it was time, enough is enough. And, you know, it's up to only the congressman himself. Again, it's up to the congressman to decide if he wants to run. And it's up to voters to decide if they want to elect him. You know, I was told as a kid that it's always better to leave a party a little bit before they want you to leave rather than an hour after they wish you would have gone. And I think some politicians sometimes might do well to remember that.
What do you think the possibility of losing John Conyers means to Michigan and to Detroit?
The question, it depends on what you want to do is go back and look and see what has John Conyers being there done for Detroit and for Michigan. Now, I'm not condoning this, there have been a lot of cases of long-term congressmen. Strom Thurmond comes to mind in South Carolina, who brought home a lot of pork barrel spending for their districts and their state. It's not at all clear to me that Conyers has done that. He hasn't really been been in a position on committees to do that or tried very hard to do that. And so what we do lose is certainly a certain amount of seniority, and it depends on assuming if John Conyers does not run, the next congressman is virtually certain to be the Reverend Horace Sheffield. Why? Because he's the only Democratic name on the ballot, and because it is impossible for a Republican to win that district, just flat out impossible. Abraham Lincoln couldn't get 20% of the vote running as a Republican in that district. So The question is how much, you know, Sheffield, of course, is starting from scratch.
Right.
They have to build a staff. And in many cases, I mean, I don't know. Conyers' office does not seem to be the best in the world at constituent services, but some people who work there are competent. And we forget a lot of times that congressmen and women, they don't just cast votes on great issues of the day. Their staffs help people find law Social Security checks. They help get people, kids into the military academies. They help link people up with services. So congressional offices are sort of a seen by a lot of people, sort of a one-stop shop for whatever they need from government. And it'll be interesting to see if whoever replaces him, whether their office is as good, better, or not as good as Conyers' office. And someday, of course, just because of the nature of human biology, John Conyers is going to have to be replaced, if not this year, relatively soon.
Michigan Radio's political commentator, Jack Lessenberry. As always, thank you, Jack.
My pleasure.
Keeping an eye on Lansing, a special state house committee today continues to dive into the details of the Detroit bankruptcy legislation. The first committee hearing on the 11 bill package was yesterday, and that's when Detroit emergency manager Kevin Orr told state lawmakers he has put together what he calls a reasonable plan, but in his blunt words, quote, "We need your money." The legislation would provide a $195 million lump sum state payment to help shore up Detroit pension funds and prevent the sale of city-owned art. The House committee will meet again tomorrow. That's when Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan is expected to testify. We'll bring you an update on the hearings tomorrow at this time on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
My failure. My failure. My divorce. My failure. My divorce.
I felt totally bamboozled. And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
And now a story of failure from Failure Lab in Grand Rapids. Here's singer-songwriter Brian Vander Ark.
Wow. Hello, I'm Brian Vander Ark. Nice to see you. I am so nervous. This is crazy. I do like 200 shows a year with a guitar in my hand. I don't get in front of people and just talk. And that's why this piece of paper is my pacifier to get me through this. And I know most of you, and that's probably the problem. They asked me to do this Failure Lab thing and come up and talk about my failures. And I thought if my dad were still alive, I'd just bring him up here and he could talk about it. Trying to keep him under 8 minutes might have been a problem. He still doesn't know how to drive a stick shift. You know, riding the clutch, whatever that means. So I'm familiar with this area quite well. I'm from Grand Rapids, and my band, the Verve Pipe, we recorded at Station C Studios, which is just down the street. It used to be. It's no longer there, on the corner of Wealthy and Diamond, and we... What we did was, this was 1992, so we found investors, and we got people to invest in two CDs that we were going to put out, and we did over the course of a couple years, and we traveled around Michigan, all of the college towns, and we sold CDs after our shows out of the back of our van. Essentially, we sold 20 to 25,000 CDs that way, so it was very successful for us in the early days, and... successful enough that we got some attention from some record labels. About six or seven labels came out to see us, and all of them passed a couple times. And then RCA came out, and they wanted to sign us. And it was a very exciting time for us in the 90s to be signed by a major label, especially one with such a great history to it. So we signed with RCA Records, and they introduced us to Jerry Harrison, who some of you might recognize Jerry's name from the Talking Heads. I was a huge Talking Heads fan. Jerry was going to produce our debut album for RCA Records, and Jerry was a terrific producer. A producer takes your songs and decides what instrumentation is going to be on them and what songs are going to be chosen. So I was very nervous about working with somebody like this. So what I did was I locked myself up in our storage space. And back in the 90s, I don't know if bands still do this, but what you did was, if you're familiar with the show Storage Wars at all, basically bands had storage spaces that they put all their equipment, but they rehearsed in there too. So there's hundreds and hundreds of these storage spaces, the sprawl of them, and bands would be in there jamming. Well, I locked myself up in this storage space, and I ate there, and I drank there, and I slept there for 10 days, and I did nothing but write and record demos for this first album. I came out dirty, of course, and I had this collection of songs, and I sent the songs to my label and to my band and to Jerry Harrison, and they all liked it, so we drove out to California, Sausalito, and we lived on houseboats, and we recorded our debut album for RCA called Villains. It was an amazing time for us, recording in the California sun. When Villains was released, it did really well. We had four top 10 hit songs, including a number one song called The Freshman, which still pays my mortgage over here in East Grand Rapids. Thank goodness. The Freshman was a tremendous hit for us. It propelled our CD sales to over a million. It was about 1.5 million, and we toured all over the world. We played Letterman and Leno, and it was a tremendous time to be in a band. But there was always that fist coming down on us, the knowledge that we knew we had to follow this up at some point. We could not live on this album forever. Now, the second album for a band, for a major label band, especially if your first album is successful, is the most crucial for that band. It's a make or break situation. You either have a successful second album and you're catapulted into superstardom, or you're forever known as a one-hit wonder. So it's a tremendous, tremendous amount of pressure. Now, I wanted to establish ourselves as a real rock band. So I decided that I wanted to talk to a producer named Michael Beinhorn. Now, Michael Beinhorn had worked with Ozzy Osbourne in the 80s, had nothing to do with our band, that's for sure. But he did produce a great album by a band called Soundgarden called Super Unknown, and I thought the album was brilliant. I met with Michael, the band met with Michael, and the guy is a genius. Speaking to him intellectually, I knew that he was going to understand I was a lyric guy. I appreciate the written word. But with that genius comes crazy. idiosyncratic behavior, I guess. I'll give you an example. We're going to record at the Hit Factory in New York, one of the greatest studios in the world. Budget was $300,000, which is pretty average. Back then, especially, to make a CD. The first day I go into the studio to work with Michael Beinhorn, I'm all excited. I'm going to go in the studio, and I talk to the receptionist, and I say, well, what's going on today? And she's, well, Michael's not here today because they're erecting the tent in the control room today. I'm like, what does that even mean, erecting the tent? So I go to the control room door, and it's a big oak door, soundproof door, and I open it up, and you're supposed to see the control room. But you have to open up the flaps to this big military tent that he had constructed. It was like the set of MASH. Right? So every day in the studio, Michael would come in, and he'd be chomping on a cigar, and he was like patting in there. You know, barking orders and this and that, which was very intimidating, I think, to a lot of the band. Now, I was in the military for about 4 years, so it didn't bother me as much. I felt like Michael was trying to get something out of us the entire time, and I appreciated that push and pull that he brought to us. Now, Michael never let me sing a song in the studio less than 100 times. I would sing the song, we'd go through all the tracks, 48 tracks, and then I'd have to re-sing them again, and then he would choose one or two, and he'd say, now sing it like that a dozen more times, and we'll get the take. And that's the absolute truth. We finally finished the album. What should have taken 3 months and $300,000 was more like 8 months and close to $1 million for this record. Now, it's okay if you're Britney Spears to spend that kind of money, but not if you're The Verve Pipe. The album was released, and when you release an album, at least a second album, you hope that the people that bought the first album will come, can't wait to get to the record store to buy that album. So a very successful album will debut, a second album will debut at about 100,000, and that'll be a number one debut. And you hope that you can realistically sell 30 or, you know, maybe 40,000 records. Our album, when it was released, sold about 7,000 worldwide. Huge, huge failure, a huge disappointment, and canceled tours and canceled appearances. I was heartbroken because we were actually bumped off of Saturday Night Live. Thank you for that. I've waited years to have a group of people go, oh, for that bit of news. You know, honestly, I got to say, but who's to blame for this? You know, is it RCA? You know, some were, you know, there was a buzz about, well, RCA dropped the ball. You know, I handed them, or the band handed them, a 400-pound bowling ball covered in grease. This album was absolutely not going to work. I couldn't blame Michael, because the fact is that the songs weren't there. I was writing songs with equipment, electronic equipment I had no business writing. I needed to get back to that storage space, I'm sure, to write those songs. So that, to me, is by far my biggest failure. As of today, you know, Villains is up. Worldwide sales are around 3 million. Thank goodness for that. This second album, they stopped selling at about 30,000 worldwide. In fact, they stopped printing them years ago, RCA did. And now, when we play shows and we want to sell that album, we actually have to go and buy the albums from someone on eBay. Thank you for having me. This felt really good to get up.
That was Brian Vander Ark telling his story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. But what happens after you fail, say at home or at work? Words of encouragement can be flung around with little thought. Think positive. That's something we hear so often, it's easy to tune it out. But there is real power in those words, the power to make our workplaces better and more effective. This week, the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan is holding its first ever Ross Positive Business Conference. Chris White leads the Center for Positive Organizations at the University of Michigan. And Chris, the fact that this is an actual area of academic study and research seems to indicate it's deeper than let's just be nice to each other.
Well, it's actually a school-wide initiative, even beyond the center that I'm involved in. At the Ross School of Business, our mission is to develop leaders who make a positive difference in the world. And what's that mean? That means that creating economic value, for sure, because it creates jobs, which we definitely need around here. It also creates great workplaces to bring out the best in people. And it means being good neighbors in our communities as well for the environment and for social impact.
So what does this idea of positive business and positive leadership, what does this look and feel like on the ground level, day in, day out at the workplace?
Yeah, on a day-to-day level in the workplace, it comes out in a few different ways. Firstly, with the leaders and how they engage their people in the organization, about 80% of the U.S. workforce is either actively disengaged or disengaged, according to a Gallup survey. So we really look at the 20% who are engaged. What are the factors that go into that? And what's the kind of leadership that can make them successful and the organizational structures and processes to support that?
When you say 80% are disengaged, that means they're going through the motions, doing their job, and just that.
Or actively disengaged goes beyond that. It means they're looking around for a new job, perhaps, or actively working against the agenda of the company.
What does a leader do to create that climate of positive business? What kinds of concepts are important for leaders to grasp?
Sure. One of the most important, really, is to create positive meaning and purpose in people's day-to-day work. the kind of things that Positive Business focuses on is how can we have an impact on the lives of people in the organizations and in society. And so if people can connect their day-to-day work with the beneficiaries of that work, then we see an uptick in their engagement levels. We see an uptick in their performance as evaluated by their peers.
What do you mean by that? But when you say when we can connect, tell me what you mean by that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a famous anecdote of someone walks along the street and sees someone laying brick and says, "What are you doing?" And the choice is either saying, "I'm laying brick, I'm building a wall," or you can be building a cathedral as well. Which of those do you assign as the meaning to what you're building there? And in day-to-day workplace, you know, you think about the really important work that's done every day by people perhaps supporting teachers in schools. Mm-hmm. Never seen. You know, are you running copies or are you helping kids to learn?
So it's that almost that half empty, half full glass of water
mm-hmm.
that you have to get into the habit of not looking at it as half empty.
Mm-hmm.
Which
and seeing the beneficiaries of your work. An important study is done at the Tele Fund here in Michigan. Actually looked at the impact of having the people making the phone calls to raise money for the university exposed to the beneficiaries of scholarships, and those who did have access to those people before starting their shift performed markedly better than those who did not, even with the same script.
So giving workers a sense of how they are an important part of this big picture, not just kind of caught like a little hamster running in its circle.
Right. There's been a lot of hype recently about how millennials really want meaning and purpose in their work. I think, Cindy, that neither of us are millennials, but we both would say that we want meaning and purpose in our work too. Managers more and more are looking for ways to identify how can we create positive purpose for people so that they can really achieve great results and feel good about what they're doing.
And overall, I guess I have to wonder if you are able to continue your mission of spreading this word about positive business and getting businesses around the state to make this happen. What could the impact be for Michigan?
Well, one of the biggest impacts is creating jobs. Fred Keller is one of the speakers at the conference coming up at the end of the week. He's CEO of Cascade Engineering. Fred's built a 1,200-person company based out of Grand Rapids there. And he's going to be talking about beyond lazy thinking, that it's okay to make money. It's great to create jobs. And we can do that while having a broader impact as well. So we have a lot of things that are great about the state of Michigan. Great tourism opportunities here. We've got great infrastructure with the airport, some great schools. How can we use these assets to create jobs and address some of the things that still need addressing?
And when I think of the things you're talking about, positive leadership, it hits me that this is not necessarily something that takes money. This just takes the understanding and then the will to follow through and the desire to make people feel appreciated.
I think that's right. And Ross Professor Jane Dutton speaks about how this creates an inimitable competitive advantage. So many companies can buy advantages, buy companies, mergers and acquisitions that are really expensive, invest in R&D. There's so much potential that's untapped in people that if leaders can become more skilled at bringing out that potential, then it creates a lot of value.
Now, I know that the first Ross Positive Business Conference, which is coming up this May 15th to the 17th, places are taken, it's full, but you're streaming it and you're already planning next year's.
That's right. We are streaming it. You can find the sessions online at www.positivebusinessconference.com. And next year's conference is slated for the 14th to 16th of May.
All right, so positivebusinessconference.com, and Chris White leads the Center for Positive Organizations at the University of Michigan. Good talking with you, Chris. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The official name is the Deep Geologic Repository Project, the DGR. It's a proposed underground site to store nuclear waste, a site that would be located less than a mile from Lake Huron, near the town of Kincardine, Ontario, just about 11 miles northeast of Port Huron on the Canadian side of the lake. Now, if Ontario Power Generation wins approval, this underground site could store 52 million gallons of low and intermediate level nuclear waste, again, less than a mile from the source of drinking water for many millions of Americans and Canadians. Nuclear scientist Frank Greening once worked for Ontario Power Generation. He says some of the materials to be stored underground are hundreds of times more radioactive than what was told to Canadian government officials who are considering the site proposal. Frank Greening, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
So tell us what you did when you worked with OPG and at this Bruce site in Kincardine.
I would do chemical and radiochemical characterization of things like pressure tubes, feeder pipes, anything they needed some information on, they'd send it to our lab, and I was in charge of that lab for up until about 2000, I worked on that. And then more recently, I was hired as a consultant at the Bruce site. I was there to do with some alpha contamination issues, and I wound up working there about 3.5 years until quite recently.
Okay, so you have written a letter expressing some concerns about information that has been given to the authorities who are going to decide whether or not this project is a go or not. What did you discover about some of the waste that could be stored underground at Kincardine?
Because I'd worked an awful lot on pressure tubes, I saw these tables of radionuclide inventories that were published by this the Nuclear Waste Organization. And just out of curiosity, I thought I'd check them. Because I had a lot of measurements of the radioactivity in these materials, and I started just doing some simple checks, and I started to see that the numbers that were being published didn't jive with my numbers. The numbers put out by the NUMO, as we call it, Nuclear Waste Management Organization, were always on the low side. So I did some more digging, thinking about it, calculations, and I realized that they had basically messed up the calculation on a lot of these important species like tritium, carbon-14, and so on and so on. The other issue as well was I noticed that they decided for some strange reason just to calculate these numbers, and they basically were ignoring the experimental data that they had access to, a lot of which was my own measurements, but other people had measured these species as well. And I was like, why are you ignoring this large body of measurements and relying on calculations? So
yes.
That's where I was coming from. That's what I did.
And before we talk about reaction to that, tell us what these pressure tubes are. I think the general public is pretty familiar with the idea of the fuel waste that can be generated. But tell us about these pressure tubes and where this radiation is.
Okay, well, this is all to do with the design of Canadian reactors, which are, there's many similarities with American reactors, but the Canadian CANDU, so-called CANDU reactor, it's based on, it's a pressure tube design. They're about 30 feet long, and they're about 6 inches in diameter. Mm. And fuel bundles, which contains the uranium, which actually starts the nuclear reaction, are pushed through these so-called fuel channels, and they sit inside the reactor core for about a year. They generate a lot of energy that is drawn off steam to run steam turbines. But in the process of sitting in the core of the reactor, these pressure tubes themselves become highly radioactive. And therefore, they are an issue when a reactor is decommissioned, or actually they have to sometimes simply replace them for various reasons. They constitute of quite a high level radioactive waste, and there's about 400 of these per reactor. So there are literally thousands of these. But when they remove them, they actually chop them up. They put them in a big chopping machine, and they cut them into coupons about the size of a matchbox, and they dump them in a big waste container, which is rather like a large skip, and they put a lid on it, and that will be the container that they wish to bury underground.
And can you give us a sense, based on the tables that you are very familiar with, Frank, by how much was the radioactivity understated in these pressure tubes when the Nuclear Waste Management Organization put those numbers together? Because it sounds as though I'm hearing you say you feel they were lowballing those numbers.
Yeah, well, because it turns out the way they did the calculation, they inadvertently ignored some of the pathways that make these radioisotopes. So then it follows that they will underestimate. It's just the whole methodology they used to calculate these isotopes that almost everyone was underestimated, some by a factor of just maybe 2 or 3, but some by factors of 100 or 1,000.
And you felt you had to point this out to them. So who got the letter? You wrote a letter expressing concern, essentially. Who did you send it to, and what was the response?
I sent it to the head of the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, a guy called Ken Nash. But I also thought that our nuclear regulator, that we call the CNSC, Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, should know about this. And the third party was the organization that is right now doing an environmental assessment of this site, and that's what we call CEA, that's the Canadian Environmental Assessment Association. So each one of these organizations got a copy of my letter.
And the response, what did you hear from them, and is there a sense that these concerns of yours are being taken seriously?
I was quite impressed by the response, because Ken Nash handed it off to one of his senior managers almost right away, and he phoned me, and he said they would look into this, and he wanted some time to check it out, which was, he said it might take a month, and it actually took 5 weeks, but then I did get a good response from them.
And we should let our listeners here in Michigan know that the Nuclear Waste Management Organization is basically a government agency that's responsible for the long-term management of spent nuclear fuel in Canada. So they'd certainly be very involved in this decision as to whether or not to allow this. What about OPG? Now, I see that they say, yes, we've checked the revised radioactivities, and the quote was, the safety case remains valid. What's your response to that?
Well, actually, that's also what the CNSC, you have the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, our equivalent organization is the CNSC. They've all given me the same answer, which is, yes, we got the numbers wrong, but if you now correct the numbers to what you say they should be, the effect on the safety case is minimal, because this site is so safe anyway, it really doesn't matter if you double the amount of radioactivity we wish to dispose of or triple it. Our estimates of the potential harm from releases are such that we're still talking about next to nothing.
And what are your thoughts as someone who's been there at the Bruce plant and who has spent a career in this business? Do you believe that, or do you disagree?
My first feeling was, look, you messed up the most basic first step in establishing the safety of this facility, namely how much radioactive waste are we going to be putting in the ground. You admit you got that wrong, but now you're telling me that everything else is okay. And there's a thing in the nuclear industry: when you have a problem, especially in the States, they do this, you have what's known as an extent of condition investigation. And what that means is you say, okay, we messed up here. Did we mess up someplace else? How bad is this error or this accident? And have we got other errors that we've missed waiting in the wings? And I accepted that, okay, you're right. But my position was, but now you just can't fluff off this error as one error. It raises too many questions about all your other numbers. And I'm sorry, I now have lost faith in what you're doing. So I've asked the CEA, the Canadian Environmental Assessment people, to do a review of the whole process of how these people are arriving at these numbers and making these proclamations of safety.
Let me ask you, as someone who has worked in the nuclear industry, is underground storage a viable option? And I guess what I'm asking, is it the fact that the concern is more about the DGR's proximity to Lake Huron being less than a mile away, or is it the very idea of an underground storage facility is a problem?
Well, you see, I would prefer to turn that question on its head and say we started nuclear power, you know, whatever it was, 40, 50 years ago. The issue of nuclear waste was always there, but it was always like, well, we'll deal with that at some future date. And so what's happened is nuclear waste has been piling up, and it's right now it's being held in basically temporary storage facilities, usually on the reactor site. And the idea of what, well, there's been many ideas about, well, what do we do with it? I mean, at one point, people were seriously suggesting that it should be put into space vehicles and shot into the sun.
I remember that. I remember hearing that.
Yeah. The trouble with that is someone then calculated it would cost about $2,000 a kilogram to do that, if in fact anyone would decide it was safe to do that. Mm. That simply the cost, because we're talking about tens of thousands of tons of this waste. So, you know, the idea of burying it in the ground has almost been thrust upon us because, quite honestly, we don't know what else to do with it. And so whether or not it's a good idea, it's like, well, we have to do something. And putting it in a hole in the ground seems to be about the only thing they can come up with.
What do you hope will come from the information you're trying to get the industry and everyone to pay attention to? What are you hoping to totally derail this project at Bruce and have them go elsewhere so it's not threatening the Great Lakes?
Well, that's pretty strong words, but I would like them to reconsider the whole project. And basically, yes, I would say I don't think that putting it on the shores of the Great Lakes, whether it be Lake Huron or Lake Michigan or Lake Ontario, Lake Erie, it doesn't matter. It's not in my... Why tempt fate? Why even put it there? Those sites were there because nuclear reactors need a lot of cooling water, so it makes sense to put a nuclear reactor, even though there's issues there, of course, about discharges into the lakes. But there was a reason to put those plants in Bruce and Pickering and Darlington on the shores of the Great Lakes. The Americans do the same thing.
Sure, we do it. We've got ours in Michigan, exactly.
But that doesn't mean to say the waste disposal site should also be put there. And I would say it's not a good idea. I think they should abandon it. They should find somewhere else.
Frank Greening is a nuclear scientist. He has worked with Ontario Power Generation, the utility that's now seeking permission to store nuclear waste underground at Kincardine, Ontario, less than a mile from Lake Huron. Frank, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
You're very welcome.
They call themselves the Tin Can Tourists. Folks who celebrate the travel trailer, the vintage travel trailer, the kind Grandma and Grandpa might have used. This weekend, the Tin Can Tourists are holding their 17th annual gathering at Camp Dearborn in Milford. Forrest Bone is the head of the Tin Can Tourists. Forrest, your girl actually dates back to 1919?
Well, in 1919 and on up into the 20s, they pretty much were driving their Model Ts with a lot of tents and canvas, utilizing the Model T as their camping vehicle. It wasn't probably until the late 20s and then that people went to covered cars rather than the Model Ts, and also started with the homemade trailers and then manufactured trailers on up into the 30s. But early on, it was strictly utilizing your Model T as your bedroom, and also, you know, they could attach the tent structures and stuff to it.
And I'm looking at your website at tincantourists.com, and there's just such an array of photographs, and you're going to have about 200 of these vintage travel trailers at Camp Dearborn this weekend. Why vintage campers? What is it that you and the other Tin Can Tourists love about them?
I think that for me, it's the interiors. The birchwood interiors are really something I like. And also, we came across a brand, Spartan, that were made after World War II. They were made by the Spartan Aircraft Company. And they have the riveted aluminum construction. And they just stood the test of time. And, you know, it'd be hard-pressed to find a trailer that you would purchase today and find it on the road 65 years later.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of a 1946 Spartan Manor, and it's kind of like a really cute little log cabin on wheels, isn't it?
It is. The construction's so great, and they did a great job with floor plans that really give you almost like an apartment feel. I mean, and you get in a 25-foot trailer, but you feel like you've got a front room, a kitchen, and a bedroom. And then the original buyer, if he had some money, he might have added even a bathroom, but a lot of them were for, you know, going into the campgrounds and the trailer parks and using their facilities for that type of stuff, showers and so forth.
Well, I have to say, as a kid who grew up with parents who took us camping all through Michigan, you can't have a better state for celebrating the joys of camping.
No, you sure can't. You know, the original Tin Can Tourists were organized in Florida, and they spent summers, they picked out the Traverse City area and also Manistee area for their winter or summer reunions.
The 17th annual gathering of the Tin Can Tourist happens this weekend at Camp Dearborn in Milford, and you can go to their website, tincantourists.com. Forrest Bone, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Happy camping.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Sade, Katie Suha, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.